in response to your tremendous support during our recently concluded membership drive, this is an all questions answered edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Financial planner Kevin McKinley is here with advice on preparing to start a family, when it pays to rent out a home, and whether retiring early is worth tapping into one's pension. And of course, there is always room for your personal finance question at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
We had such a wonderful pledge drive just concluded, and this is a special thank you edition of On Your Money. We will devote the entire show to answering personal finance questions as promised, because of the generous support during our pledge drive. What do you have to say about, people really love this show and your advice, Kevin.
Yeah, that's why I show up every week.
Yeah.
During last week's membership drive show, we asked for your support of On Your Money and more so Wisconsin Public Radio. And along with other premium items, anyone who pledged during On Your Money received a copy of the On Your Money mini money booklet, On Your Money for Parents and Grandparents.
And once again, On Your Money listeners responded in full force. Did you tally the totals?
I did. I counted them as they came in, which was the reason I sounded a little distracted during the show. But during Tuesday's live show and Saturday's rebroadcast, 530 people pledged. Woo-hoo. Over $35,000 total. All of that money, 100% of it, goes directly to Wisconsin Public Radio. So thank you very much, those of you who stepped up, reached deep into your pockets, and helped out.
Great support for On Your Money, and overall, Wisconsin Public Radio exceeded its goal during this recently concluded pledge drive. So thank you, thank you, thank you. And besides saying thank you, how else are we showing our gratitude?
We are going to, of course, devote this entire hour to answering your questions. You can call 800-642-1234, send an email to kevin@onyourmoney.com, or post your question on the Joy Cardine Facebook page.
So let's start with a question from Stephanie in Milwaukee, who writes, On Your Money is one of my favorite recurring programs on WPR. I have a question that for the first time is causing me to write in. I'm getting married this year, but I am planning on waiting a bit to start a family. What kind of financial moves can I do to help prepare? Is there a good amount of money to have tucked away? Thanks, and keep being awesome.
That's so good. That implies that we were awesome. Yes. Before this, so we'll take that admonition. Thank you very much, Stephanie, and congratulations. We did discuss this a little bit in our own On Your Money mini money booklet, but we'll give you a brief synopsis. It's a good idea for both parents and non-parents and those who are prospective parents to start tracking your spending right now. Find out where everything is going, and more importantly, find out what you can cut, because you will definitely need to spend less so that you can save more. If you're struggling right now and you're having a hard time paying your bills, it can be even worse once you choose to have children. And it's a great long-term habit to track your expenses. You know, I've done this now. This is my 29th year for as being a financial planner or advisor, whatever you want to call it. And one common denominator I've found with the people who are financially independent by the age at which they would like to be financially independent, in their 50s and 60s, is they track every single expense, and they even keep those logs so they can see what we spend in 2006 and 2007, and how are we doing now compared to those years back then?
I think this is awesome that Stephanie is trying to have enough money tucked away to start a family. I don't think everybody thinks along those lines. But if she does have some money left over, where should it go?
She should start building her cache of cash. I'd like to see, if she asked about a number, that what should she shoot for. She should have at least 3 months' worth of living expenses set aside. And the nice thing about tracking your spending is, of course, you can find out what your living expenses are and then multiply it by three. And that's how much you should have in some kind of relatively safe, relatively accessible account. And the reason I like 3 months is because that's about the average time that most people who lose their jobs are out of work. So 3 months of living expenses can help her get through any kind of short-term cash crunch. And if she's younger and working, she should definitely save for retirement now. And if she makes $50,000 or more as a single person or getting married, $100,000 if they're married filing jointly, she should use her pre-tax plan at work to save for retirement, like the 403B or the 401K. But if she's making less than that, or if she just doesn't have quite enough to cover that 3 months of living expenses, she should instead use the Roth IRA. She won't get a tax break on the contributions for it, but she can withdraw those contributions at any time for any reason with no taxes or penalties whatsoever. And the goal for her and most other young adults like her should try to save at least $5,000 per person per year to her retirement account. So if it's a couple, they should try to save $10,000 a year for the retirement account for the two of them. And if they can do that, if they can just save $5,000 per year, and if they get a hypothetical return of 6% after 35 years, that should be worth about $500,000.
So any other financial moves prospective parents should take?
Yeah, there's a couple that a lot of people don't actually consider because it's not an enjoyable subject to talk about, but they should look at life insurance. If they're going to have kids, they're going to need life insurance. And before getting pregnant, sometimes health complications can come along with the pregnancy, which can make it more difficult to get life insurance after the child is born. They should get a term life insurance policy. It should last for about 25 years because hopefully the kid will be old enough at that point where she won't be relying on her parents anymore. And they should get it for about $500,000 per parent. That sounds like a lot of money. But when you purchase term life insurance, it's generally not very expensive. According to termforsale.com, a female who's 30 can get a $500,000 25-year term life insurance policy for about $25, and a male is about $30 per month in premium. So it's relatively affordable, especially for the great need that you'll have, and you hope that it becomes a big waste of money.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. You should consult with your financial advisor prior to making any investment decisions. If you have a personal finance question for Kevin during this thank you edition of On Your Money, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Well, speaking of insurance, Erin in La Crosse has a question about that. Hi, Erin.
Hi. First, thanks for doing the show. I really appreciate listening to you. It's always good advice.
Always.
And my question is, I have a life insurance policy through work, and it is a transferable policy if I were to ever leave my job. It didn't require me to have any kind of physical at the onset, but if I were to withdraw and then try to go back and retain insurance from them, I'd have to get a physical. And recently I had a sit down with a financial advisor who started talking about the different options for insurance. Right now my policy is about $300,000. And just to let you know, I'm 38 years old. I own a home. And I'm not married. I don't have any kids. And he was talking with me about getting a universal or whole life insurance policy. And with that, I did the medical exam, but he told me that he couldn't get me my premiums, my rates, until I signed on with the insurance program, which kind of made me feel uncomfortable. Can you give me any details about the differences between the policies, maybe what's a good direction to go into? I heard that you had just talked about term life insurance for the previous question. But what would be the benefits?
Yeah, the you've really done a great job, Erin, of checking all this out. Back up for a second, though. Is anyone, are you supporting anyone, child, partner, parent?
I have a partner.
Okay,
yeah.
You have a partner. And is, excuse me, is the need for the life insurance in your mind come for supporting the partner? It's perfectly fine, but I want to know if that's the goal of this.
It does. It's, you know, any debt resolution and then a window of opportunity to support my partner if I were
okay.
To. Yeah.
Yep, and that's perfectly fine. A couple things I'm concerned about. One is that you should be able to know what the cost of a program is before you have to sign up for it. And one of the reasons people tend to balk when it comes to buying cash value life insurance, which is universal life or whole life or whatever, is that it is much more expensive than term life insurance. And oftentimes that is sold as a notion of saying, well, there's an investment component to it. You can make money on this. And I'm guessing the agent probably brought that up during the conversation, right?
Yes.
Yep. That's not a guarantee. Sometimes it is. Sometimes, especially people who have older, more mature cash value policies, they're making actually a nice interest rate on it, like 3 or 4%. And that's guaranteed by the life insurance company. That guarantee is not as safe as, say, a certificate of deposit, but it's still pretty safe in most cases. But when people are trying to get you to sign up for new life insurance policies, they usually use a projected rate of return. And they might use like 6% or 8% or more. And in my mind, especially at this point in history, I don't think that's going to be an achievable rate of return. And if it's not, then all of a sudden the policy starts to look not as attractive and you have to pay a lot more money into it because the cash you've put in and invested as part of the policy isn't earning the projected rate of return. And so I would not only make sure you know what it's going to cost, but I would ask the salesperson to demonstrate to you, tell you what interest rate they used in their hypothetical projections, and then lower that down, cut it in half. If they're using 8%, say, well, what's it going to look like at 4% or 2% even? Because these policies are very expensive, and the net return to you may not be nearly as high as the projection. I'd much rather have you purchase term life insurance, and I'd rather have you purchase it for something to say, you know, you're 38, maybe 20 or 25 years. That should take you into your 60s, and you'll still find that it's much, much less expensive to buy the term life insurance than it is to get a cash value policy. And this person who's talking to you highly likely can offer that as well. It's just that he or she doesn't make as much in commission off of the term policy as they do off the cash value. Therefore, they have less of a financial incentive to offer it. So I wouldn't go towards the cash value unless you had some kind of permanent insurance needs, such as, you know, you're trying to pay estate taxes. Sometimes business owners need permanent life insurance so that if they die, there is a cash option for partners in the business or to help fund the business in their absence. That's more of an appropriate time for universal whole life insurance, but I wouldn't buy it based on the information you've given me.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Aaron. Good luck to you. Kevin, I've never heard of such a thing. I guess to not tell you how much you have to pay for an insurance until you say you're going to buy it.
Oh, I like that. It makes it fun. I like to go to a restaurant with no prices on the menu and just go, you know what? I'm going to have the steak and I'm just going to be so surprised when I get the bill.
No, that's ridiculous. Anyway, we are talking about your personal finance issues during this thank you edition of On Your Money. Financial planner Kevin McKinley is here. We are thanking you with an entire hour of your personal finance questions as a way to thank you for your support during our recently concluded pledge drive. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I need
Thank you for your support during our recently concluded pledge drive. And as promised, we are devoting this entire hour to answering your personal finance questions. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. Our number, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our next caller is Jeff in Spooner. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. So the question I have is this. My wife and I are both retired in our early 60s. We have a mortgage of $38,000, and we'd like to pay that mortgage off, and we've got over about $55,000 in a savings account, and we've got over about $600,000 in our Edward Jones investments, with about $300,000 of that being in Roth IRAs. And we're wondering, what's the best way to pay off that mortgage? A combination of the Roth and the savings, or just tap into the Roths?
Jeff, do you have any big expenses coming up that you would need to use that $38,000 or the $55,000 for?
No, our only debt is the mortgage.
Okay, good for you. Here's what I would do. I would probably pay that off, and were I to do it, I would use the $55,000, $38,000 of that, because you'll still have $17,000 in cash, and you do have the Roth IRAs, which you can get at if you need more of that money, and ostensibly can probably get that out tax-free. And I'm guessing you're probably, you have just Social Security as your only income, or do you have a pension as well?
No, I have a pension through Wisconsin Retirement System. We haven't taken Social Security yet. We're
okay.
Holding off.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Then what I would do is I would use that cash that you've accumulated to pay off the mortgage, but I would establish a home equity line of credit and go back to the bank. Do you have one of those, Jeff, or have you used one before?
I've used them before many times, yeah.
Okay, good. Then what I would do is, for those who don't know, a home equity line of credit gives you the right to borrow against the accumulated equity in your home up to a certain extent without having to apply for the loan at that particular time. It's like an option to borrow against it. When you borrow against it, you only pay interest on what you've borrowed, and what you generally pay it off for several years. You can pay it off at any time, or they'll convert it to a fixed rate loan maybe 5 to 10 years down the road. And the interest rate runs anywhere from 3 to 5% per year. And the interest can be tax deductible. And I like that because it's just one more way to tap into the equity you've accumulated. And if you get in a situation, Jeff, where you say, we need some money, we need it in a hurry, it's a good thing that happened. Maybe, you know, the kid's getting married, or we can help them buy a house, or it's a bad thing that's happened. We have an uncovered medical emergency that we need to pay for as soon as possible. The home equity line of credit gives you the option to get that cash back out that you've paid off for it. And I'm guessing your expenses are low enough where the mortgage payment is probably a pretty big chunk of that, right?
Yeah, actually, our mortgage payment is only $400 a month.
Okay. And what's the interest rate on the mortgage?
3.2.
Okay, that's a very good rate, and if you had other uses for the money, I would say not to pay it off, but if you just can't think of anything else to do with it and you have no foreseeable need for it, I'd say, yeah, go ahead and pay that off.
Okay, great. Thank you for your help.
All right. Thanks very much, Jeff, for the call. Nice position to be in. Tom in South Beloit, Illinois is with us now. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. It's good to talk to the man who knows everything.
No, I'm sorry. It's Kevin McKinley on today.
Okay. Your previous caller talking about insurance triggered me to call and ask you something I've been meaning to ask you for a long time. Way back when, my wife and I both got whole life insurances policies. Sometime during the 80s, we were persuaded by an insurance agent to change them into a hybrid type of policy where they have a cash value, but the premiums would, you know, you'd have term insurance bought year after year. Well, as the years have gone by and we've gotten older, the term insurance has gotten more and more expensive to the point that it's going in the opposite direction now, where the cash value is going down to make up the difference, even with the dividends and the interest and stuff. It seems to me that somewhere in the past you had recommended a website or somebody where you could have that evaluated and see if it was time to just pull a plug on the thing.
Yeah, you're correct. I did recommend that. Would you like me to give it to you?
Yes, please.
Okay, good. Yes, it's called evaluatelifeinsurance.org. evaluatelifeinsurance.org, and it's part of the Consumer Federation of America. And what they'll do is they'll take a look at your policy for a very low cost and tell you more than what you're going to get from the agent generally in terms of the actual cost, decide whether your existing policy is worth keeping. And, you know, you do have to turn the information over to them. But if I recall correctly, it's maybe like, I want to say that it's less than a couple hundred dollars, which is a very low cost for it. Now, there's another life insurance expert I know of named Glenn Daly, who I've worked with in the past in helping clients, and he does a good job too. His is more expensive, not a lot more expensive, but it's more expensive, but it's more thorough. And so what I would do is I would start with the evaluatelifeinsurance.org site, see if they can get you the answers you want, and then go on to somebody like this Glenn Daly. And I'll put links to both
Could
of
I
their
get a
websites.
Follow-up?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
would you talk at all about the possibility of just changing those into paid, you know, where we just paid them in full?
Yeah, I can talk about it. It depends on your situation and your needs. You know, usually it's a pretty in-depth discussion to decide if you actually need the life insurance or not. And a lot of people forget that if they're in a married couple and one member dies, generally the lesser of the Social Security checks disappears. And the expenses don't go down as much as the disappearing Social Security check. And if you don't have sufficient assets to cover that loss over the longer term, you may still need the life insurance. So we'll probably talk about that in a few weeks, Tom, on another episode. But otherwise, I'd still keep the policy in place for the time being and get an evaluation of it and see what they say.
Good luck to you, Tom. Thank you for the call. And thank you for your support of On Your Money and Wisconsin Public Radio during our recently concluded pledge drive. We are devoting this entire edition of On Your Money to answering your questions, your personal finance questions. Our number is 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Barb in Milwaukee is with us now. Hi, Barb.
Good morning. Yes, my husband and I are in our early 60s, and we had put some retirement savings in one of those incremental funds that every year was supposed to get more and more conservative so you didn't lose all your money just before you retired. But we recently were told by the financial institution that, oh, because of a glitch, your money's actually just been in a cash fund, earning like 0.1%. So now we're in this situation. They're like, so you should probably move that money. We're like, yeah, but where now that the stock market's so high and everything? So I'm wondering if you have any advice for us, Kevin.
Well, did the company offer any explanation of this other than just it's a glitch?
No. Well, my husband spoke to them, and this is what the gist I got out of it.
I would check with them and see if they have an explanation for it. Is this your only asset or your main asset?
Main, yeah.
Okay. You know, the stock market is very high, and there's a lot of risk out there. There always will be. And you may want to move it into something that is like this because who knows? You know, a lot of people thought the stock market was going to crash 3 months ago and 6 months ago and a year ago, and it didn't. And it still may today or tomorrow or the next day. But if you have long-term investment goals, one of these kinds of funds is okay. And it's not the kind of fund generally, especially if it's a more conservative one. Is it like a target date fund, Barb? Is that the phrase they
use? That's what we were supposed to be in, yes.
Okay. Let's go over the issue or skip over the issue with the company because you have to deal with them and see what they say about how they can rectify the situation. But in terms of investing in it, if it's a target date fund, especially if it's a target retirement income fund, those can be they can have some volatility because there is generally a stock component to it. But there's also a bond component and a cash component as well. And the cash doesn't make you anything, but it usually doesn't lose anything. The bonds don't make very much, but usually don't lose very much. The stock component is the one that you might be concerned about. But you can go to like, a, for instance, the Vanguard Retirement Income Fund is one of these kinds of funds. And the cash component for the, or the stock component, rather, is relatively small. It might be, I don't recall exactly, but I think it might be a third of it. Well, even let's say that drops in half. That's still only a 15% drop. And the hope is that over the very long time, and if you're in your early 60s, you're probably going to have a very long time of retirement. The hope is that this will provide something that exceeds the base rate of this money market. But you might want to, if you do choose to invest it, you might want to invest just a portion of it for the time being. And then if prices go down in the future, maybe invest more of it in the future. I'm sorry that happened to you. But again, in terms of dealing with the company, go back to them and say, you know, what are you going to do about this? And if they can't do anything, then it's up to you to decide what your next steps are.
Yeah. Barb, thank you very much for the call. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money. Our next question is from a listener who writes, we married this year and now we have to move for his job. What are the pros and cons of selling our home in Madison versus renting it out? Renting versus selling, Kevin.
Let's talk about the cons first of being a landlord. You have to deal with tenants, and tenants are basically your customers, and you're tied into them much more so than if you're running, you know, a hamburger stand, because they're living in an entity, an asset that you own. They can damage your place advertently or inadvertently. They cannot pay you. And then if they don't pay you for a long enough period of time, you have to evict them. And evicting tenants is not a case of just saying, please leave, and they move out. You can have to go to court with them. You can involve a, you know, law enforcement if they won't leave. And so it can be very difficult. Even for one property, if you have just the one property, it can seem like a part-time job, especially if there's a lot of turnover, meaning every year the old tenants move out, you have to find new ones, you have to show the place to people, it has to look good when they show it, you have to make an appointment with it, and it can really take up a lot of your time.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like a lot of fun, but won't you be able to clear some extra money each month over and above the mortgage payment and the taxes?
Yeah, that's the theory, and most months that's the case, but that extra money can quickly be wiped out if you have any vacancies or you have tenants who won't pay. Any repairs or maintenance, which as a rule of thumb, you can plan to spend maybe 3 to 5% of the home's value every single year in maintenance costs and upgrades, especially if you have to repair things that the tenants haven't taken care of and you can't get the money from them. Now, of course, you can hire a property manager who will take care of a lot of the hassle of renting out your place, but there's a cost to that as well, and it still doesn't cover any lost rent or maintenance expenses that you have to kick in yourself.
So are you saying forget about it when it comes to renting out?
Not necessarily. I still think it's something to pursue. And over the long period of time, it can be a great investment for people. I have several clients who made a lot of money over the very long time by having rental real estate. But it takes a lot of time. It takes expertise. You usually have to make money on it on an ongoing basis. You have to have the skill and the ability to do a lot of the repairs and upgrades yourself. And you have to have some extra money to fall back on, because if you have a place that's not paid for and it has a mortgage payment, sometimes if they move to a new place, they're going to have two mortgage payments and the rent might not come in fast enough from the tenants, and they could find themselves in a bind if they don't have other sources of cash to cover the loan payments. For this couple, maybe keep it if they're thinking they might return to Madison within a year or two, after which they'll know, first of all, if they like being landlords, and second, if they're going to be moving back to Madison. And if they can answer no to either one of those questions, then it might be a good time to sell.
1-800-642-1234. If you have a personal finance question for financial planner Kevin McKinley, you can also email it to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Chris in La Crosse is with us now. Hi, Chris. What's your question?
I guess it's a good problem to have. My wife my wife took a job that is having us move. Part of the job description involves provision of free housing. So what we're doing is we're selling the current home we're in. And I want to ask two questions. Is what do we do to avoid, since we're not going to purchase a new home, to avoid any potential capital gains that we'd have to pay if we then reinvested in a new home instead? And then what we should then do with the additional $12,000 to $15,000 we're freeing up in expenses that we can then use to invest in something else?
Chris, yeah, that is a good problem to have. You probably won't have any capital gains taxes on the home because you don't have to roll that into a new place. You can exclude up to $500,000 of capital gains for married couples filing jointly from the sales proceeds of your primary residence. And you don't have to buy a new place to do that. So that part is not a concern. Is this something, Chris, that you see that you won't need a house indefinitely, or do you think maybe in 2 or 3 years you probably might have a different job or a different living situation where you would need to purchase a house again?
It's probably indefinitely. That being said, I want to have the money because we want to get our kids through high school, which is 5 to 6 years or so, and then consider where our next options are. But at least for that period of time, we should be okay.
Okay. You should, and I'm sorry, you said are you getting $12,000 to $15,000 a year extra that you'll have left over?
We're figuring that, well, based because between what we've been paying in mortgage and property taxes and maintenance and all that, we're figuring that's probably what it's going to save us.
All right. First of all, I would max out your pre-tax retirement accounts. If you have 401ks or 403bs that you can, I would max those out. The second thing, I would use the money to put into Roth IRAs if you qualify. Do you qualify to contribute to Roth IRAs?
Yes.
All right. And were you going to contribute to those anyway, or would this extra money come in handy for that?
We have been contributing to various IRAs and things, but we'd have to take a look at, you know, that's kind of what we're trying to figure out is what we want to put into those things.
Yep. I'd use the Roth IRAs again because you don't get a tax break on it, but any earnings are sheltered from taxation. That money is usually not included in the financial aid calculations that the colleges will make when they award need-based aid to your family. But you can pull the contributions back out whenever you want if you need to help the kids out for college or you need to use that to, for some reason, to make a down payment on your new house. The money does not, it's not taxable, and there's not penalized when you pull the contributions out. It can affect the subsequent year's financial aid because it might show up as income on that. But that's what I would do with the extra money. And actually, the maximum Roth IRA contribution you can make is $5,500 per year per person if you're under 50. That's $11,000, and it's $6,500 if you're over 50. So that's $13,000 right there. So that should do a good job of eating the whole bit up, and then wait till the kids get in college, and having too much money will not be a problem.
Is 529 a good choice of investment as well, potentially?
It can be, but how old are your kids, Chris?
One is a sophomore in high school, one's an eighth grader.
All right. It can be a nice one. Are you going to be staying in the state of Wisconsin, or are you going somewhere else?
We are staying in the state of Wisconsin.
All right.
We don't know where the kids are going to go.
Okay, if you're filing as Wisconsin residents, you can use the EdVest plan, the 529 plan, EdVest. And you can get a small state income tax break on the deposit. So that might be a good thing for the extra, any extra money you have left over beyond the retirement plan contributions. I wouldn't expect to make a lot of money in that plan over the short period of time. But again, those can also be sheltered from the need-based aid awarded. And any earnings are sheltered from taxation. And then any distributions are tax-free as long as they're for qualified higher education. So you might want to do maybe about $3,000 per kid per year. And that'll save you maybe about $100 to $150 in state income taxes.
Good luck to you, Chris. Glad you're staying in the state of Wisconsin so you can keep listening to On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. This is a thank you edition of On Your Money, devoting the entire hour to your questions as a way of saying thank you for your support for Wisconsin Public Radio and On Your Money during our recently concluded pledge drive. 1-800-642-1234 is the number to call if you have a question for Kevin. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine along with financial planner Kevin McKinley answering your personal finance questions today from start to finish at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Rod in Milwaukee is with us. Hi, Rod.
Good morning. Longtime listener to the Wizard of Finance. So, my question is this: I am 73 years old, and I had completed my tax preparations this year, and I was surprised to learn that I had a small amount of earned income during the year working at State Fair, and about $600. I thought I could use that as a tax deduction and put that amount into my Roth IRA, but I was told by my tax preparer that that was not allowable because of my age.
Hmm. You're sure it was clear to your tax preparer that it was a Roth IRA?
Yes.
Okay. You don't get any tax break on a Roth IRA, but you can definitely make a Roth IRA contribution even after reaching age 70 and a half. What you can't do is make an IRA contribution, a tax-deductible one. So I would clarify that with the tax preparer. And Rod, just out of curiosity, what was your job at the State Fair?
I was a guest relations specialist, which means basically that I would be sitting in a booth when someone could say, where's the birthing barn? I would say, it's over in the west side of the place.
Well, I'm glad to hear that that is a job that hasn't yet been outsourced by
That's
technology.
Right.
Very good. I hope you had your share of cream puffs while you're there.
Well, no, but they're definitely available.
All right. All right. Thanks,
okay.
Rod, for the call. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Here's a question from Steve who writes, Kevin and Joy, despite being a longtime loyal listener, there's always something new I learn with each show. Same here. because of this, your show is my favorite on WPR. And he says that ought to take care of the false praise part of this. Okay.
It does.
Yeah,
thank
it does.
You.
Very good. He goes on to say that he and his wife are in their late 50s and would like to retire within a few years, but they are concerned that her pension makes up a big portion of their retirement savings and that it's invested more aggressively than they would prefer it to be. So he wants to know if it's a good idea for her to retire earlier than planned, just to make sure that they can start getting the payments from her pension. What do you think, Kevin?
Well, pensions, Joy, are great as long as they work as they're supposed to. The problems come when the investments within the pension underperform expectations, or if the calculations made by the pension administrator are incorrect, and usually that involves life expectancy. They assume that all the pension recipients are going to die at a certain age, and most of the people live longer than that. They can run into trouble. And then when they do run into trouble, the question is, what happens if there's not enough money to support the payments? Who has an incentive to prop up the pension and kick money into it? If it's a private pension, is the company going to pull money out of their earnings where they would just as soon keep it or use it for future growth or to pay for current employees and marketing and manufacturing? And if it's a public pension, are the taxpayers going to be willing to subsidize a small portion of the population for something that technically they have no benefit from?
So what happens if there is a shortfall?
Typically, in a given year, these companies that run these pensions run the calculation and they say, whoops, we've got to add some more money into the pension because we didn't make as much as we planned on making. But again, the company may not want to and they may not be able to. And in extreme cases, the company may declare bankruptcy to get out of the pension obligation and then turn the pension over to the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which is kind of a government body which administers this, will take it over. And then based on premiums and insurance kicked in, has hopefully enough money so that the pension beneficiaries can still get the checks that they're promised. But it's only up to a certain amount. And this Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation has not endured a huge wave of pension defaults all at once, meaning a bunch of companies saying, we can't meet our obligations, interest rates are too low, the stock market hasn't performed well enough, we don't have the money to kick into it, and quite frankly, we just as soon pay ourselves and our employees first rather than some 84-year-old who hasn't worked for the company for 40 years. Therefore, we're giving up on the pension.
So do you think that Steve's wife should retire early to get what she can get right now?
Probably not. That shouldn't be the only reason anyway. Just because she's getting payments in retirement and is part of the pension, it doesn't mean they're necessarily guaranteed by an act of God that they'll always be there for. They're still subject to these normal risks that the pension is subject to for people who haven't received it yet. Instead, I'd consider it as one factor in the decision, along with their health, their life expectancy, what kind of health care costs they might have. If they're under 65, how are they going to pay for health insurance if they can't get it on their own? And how much she enjoys the job. If she really likes it, I wouldn't quit just because of the pension. But that said, in the meantime, keep other investments as conservative as possible, because when you have a pension, especially if it constitutes a large part of your expected retirement income, you don't have any control over that pension, and you have very little knowledge over even where it's invested. And so you'd be better off erring on the side of caution with your other money, keeping it in safer investments like CDs. And yes, you're giving up potential return, but if you've given up a potential return that's really good, the pension will probably grow stronger and be more likely to be there. And if it doesn't, you'll be very glad that you preserved what you had so you can live off of that.
This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. And our next caller is Kate in Elm Grove. Hi, Kate.
Hi there.
Hi.
This is the most informative and most enjoyable show on PBS.
Thank you very much, Kate. I appreciate it.
NPR.
Thank you.
My husband and I are in the throes of trying to replace one car and then another car a little later on. Our history has been that we keep cars for an inordinate amount of time. But what I'm thinking about now is, what would be the benefit to leasing over buying? I'm 70 and he's 68. What can you tell me?
If you usually keep cars for a long time, it's generally better off to actually purchase them rather than leasing them. Leasing is better for people who say, I only am going to have this car for a few years. I don't have a lot of extra cash on hand. I can make the monthly lease payment. But when you lease a car, what you're doing is you're borrowing the value of what the current cost of the car is versus what the dealership expects the value of the car to be at the end of the lease. If you buy a $30,000 car and the dealership expects it to be worth $10,000 after 5 years, you only have to borrow the $20,000 and only make payments on that. And that means your payments are going to be smaller than if you were to pay the full cash price for the loan. But it does mean that you have limits in terms of the mileage of what you can put on it. And it means that any nicks or dings or dents that happen to the vehicle that you would normally care about, you may get penalized for those financially when you turn the vehicle back in. It can provide an advantage for a savvy car buyer, though, because at the end of the lease, Kate, what happens is you can either buy the car for that the residual value of it, what's left over, let's say the $10,000 in my example, or you can give it back to the dealership and say, I either don't want this car or I can buy another one just like it for $8,000 and I can save myself some money. That kind of gives you an option to put the vehicle back to the dealer at a certain price. And the other part about it that can be good or bad is the interest rate of the lease. It's still a loan, and sometimes, I want to say unscrupulous dealers, but dealers who are interested in making as much profits as they possibly can will obfuscate that interest rate. So they'll just say, well, can you afford $300 a month? You can, then great. We can get you a car. And they don't tell you that you're paying, 8% interest on the lease rather than the 3 or 4% that people with good credit can get if they borrow the money themselves. So you want to know, not just
spectacular credit. So
okay, good. Then I would definitely want to know what the interest rate is, and if it's not an acceptable figure, you can get leases from lease loans, if you will, from most credit unions or banks. They'll arrange a lease for you if you'd like, and then you can maybe get it at a more attractive rate. But it's best if you just only plan on driving the car for maybe 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Are there any websites out there that you can plug this all into, and it'll tell you yay or nay?
Yeah, the Edmunds.com is a pretty good one that they'll give you some information on in terms of leasing. I like their Consumer Reports, obviously, is good. They don't talk as much about leasing as some of the other car dealerships sites do, but I'd go to Edmunds.com, and we'll put a link up to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Thank you, Kate. Good luck to you, and thank you for the kind words. Jeff in Hayward is with us now. Hello, Jeff. What's your question?
Good morning, Joy. Good morning, Kevin. My question is this. My wife and I are finally all done with school. I graduated about 2 years ago, and we are both earning six figures. I have about $230,000 in student loan debt. We owed about $140,000 on our mortgage, and we have about combined $50,000 in car loans and about $30,000 in revolving credit. Now, we wanted to remodel our house. It was a starter home, and we're looking at remodeling the house and adding like a mother-in-law suite or selling our house and buying another one. But every time we talk to a bank about either option, my student loan debt, regardless of our income, has created too much of a debt-to-income ratio.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I work for a state government, so I'm on the 10-year loan forgiveness plan, and I like that plan, and I'd like to stay on it.
Good.
But what is the best line of attack we can have for our income to our debt to shift that dynamic to where we could actually take out a loan to either add on to our house or to buy a bigger house?
It's a good question. You may, and it's a tough situation because most mortgages are actually resold, and the bank or the credit union doesn't keep them. They don't, and when they're resold, they have to fit into relatively narrow parameters, and that's where you're probably running into the biggest problem. Somebody else who says, we would just keep the loan for ourselves and maybe put it on an adjustable rate mortgage, they might be more tolerant of the debt-to-income ratio. But in your case, it might be a while before you do that. You can go, Jeff, to, there are websites like Prosper, LendingTree, et cetera, who you can put your information in there, and they will give you oftentimes a quote back if someone else is willing to lend you the money that you want to get. But it's going to be at a higher interest rate probably than what you're expecting to pay from a traditional mortgage or home equity line of credit. What is your home worth roughly, Jeff?
I think our last fair market value was $158,000, and I mean, so we have a little bit of equity. We did talk to our current mortgage holder about a refinance to try and cash in on some of the equity. and their closing fees were about $17,000.
So yeah, they'd just wipe out whatever they went to.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Right. Yeah, that's probably what I would look at doing, is trying to get some kind of external financing, see if you can get maybe a consumer loan and go to one of the alternative places. But it's really tough to get past that. Now, that said, once the student loan's wiped off of there, you're going to be in much, much better shape, obviously, to the point where you can whittle down those loans a lot faster. I would go through your spending right now, Jeff, and even with a good income, and I know that these debt payments eat up a lot of it, I would look for whatever else you can cut to try to whittle things down. And as bad as the student loans are, the credit card debt is probably not helping you either, because that's an unsecured debt, and it's looked upon least favorably by the credit scores, because it has the highest interest rate, and there's really not much chance of forgiveness unless you declare bankruptcy, and you don't want to do that, because by the time the bankruptcy gets off of your credit report, if you stay with the state, hopefully the loans will almost be forgiven by that time either. So it's better off to do it. I'd say, you know, you probably are where you are, and unless you can figure out a way to retire that debt faster and get it down to a point where the banks are happier to give you the money, it's going to be tough to get through that. But zero out those expenses wherever you can. It involves a lot of effort, but you've already done that to have to get through law school and all this other stuff.
Yeah. Okay. So, we'll check out what alternatives we have on the financing. But so what I'm hearing is really attacking the revolving credit would probably be the best benefit for us.
Yep. Because that's the highest interest rate, and the worse your financial situation gets, the more likely it is that the credit card companies will say, well, you were paying us 9%. We took a look at your credit. You're now going to pay us 18%, which can cause you to get even deeper in the hole. The mortgage payment, the car loan payment, and to a great extent, the student loan payments are probably on a fixed interest rate. So at least you know what you're getting into with that. The credit cards are the ones that can kind of get out of hand.
Good luck, Jeff. I'm going to see if we can squeeze one more question in. Tina in Guttenberg, Iowa. Hi, Tina.
Hi, it's Gina. And yeah, my question is, I had $5,000 from the sale of my late husband's home that I put into an annuity for my 25-year-old son who's on disability. I was just wondering if I did a good thing there, or if there's also a mutual fund account that my father set up for him. It's about $2,000, and I'm wondering if maybe I should get that out of a market situation and maybe start depositing into that annuity.
I probably wouldn't put any more money in the annuity. Is there some special factor about that annuity, Gina, that helps your son out for, in funding, if he's still getting like some kind of public support?
Yeah, he's getting disability payments. Yeah.
Okay, so the money in the annuity is protected from that won't hurt his
support? It was from the
Okay. I would talk to an attorney if you haven't already, especially someone who specializes in how to set up structures so that you can support it without disqualifying him from any aid. The $2,000 that you might want to just keep in your checking account, and that might be a good emergency source of funds for you, or to help him out if he needs it, again, as long as it doesn't disqualify him from any potential public assistance.
Thank you, Gina. I think 30 seconds for the website of the week, Kevin.
Well, let's go to that Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, pbgc.gov, because you can not only check on the health of your pension and see if it's covered by this safety net, but you can also look up and see if you or a loved one has a pension out there that they qualify for that they haven't received. pbgc.gov, and we'll have that at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Four more words then before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Thanks to Bill Martins for producing this program. Thank you for listening, and thanks for your support during our just concluded pledge drive. This is The Ideas Man.